Hey listeners, before I get into this episode, I have a quick ask to make. I started this podcast as a research project on how to be a top individual contributor in the product design space. My goal for the show was to learn what it takes to be an individual contributor that is doing amazing, impactful work that they love doing day in and day out and getting paid top dollar while they do it. Becoming that type of individual contributor is the ultimate job security. With close to 100 hours of interview recordings, this has naturally led to the creation of the short-form video articles that synthesize my learnings into 10-minute listens of actionable content. You might recognize these as my morning walk episodes or the hashtag shorts episodes. To my surprise, those episodes have been very well received and listeners have enjoyed the synthesis of what I've learned. This has led to the next chapter of my research project, which is beginning to synthesize what I've learned into a new newsletter called Thinking Out Loud About Design that you can subscribe to right now for free. Thinking Out Loud About Design is an email newsletter and podcast that basically contains all my synthesis for my long-form interviews. It's pure distilled learnings that you can apply to your career immediately. This content is for you if you are a couple years into your career and you're trying to make that move from mid-level to senior designer and senior designer to staff designer. I mainly focus on becoming high-performing individual contributors in the product design industry. A free subscription gives you full access to the newsletter, podcast episodes, and website. You won't have to worry about missing anything because every new edition of the newsletter goes directly into your inbox. So my ask is this. If you have gotten any value out of the way of product design, or if it's helped you in any way or someone you know, please subscribe to Thinking Out Loud About Design and get the distilled learnings on being a staff-level individual contributor. You can find a link to the newsletter in the show notes of every episode of this podcast and on my LinkedIn page. Just look up Caden Damiano. Thanks again for listening and supporting the way of product design. I wouldn't be doing this if you guys weren't listening. Now, on to the show. Welcome to the Way of Product Design. I'm Caden Damiano. We know design is valuable, but how can you unlock its true value and tie your design work to business impact? This show interviews product designers, product managers, and tech leads from places like Google, Domo, Divi, IBM, Intuit, and Uber to find out what makes a valuable product designer and how you can be one as well. Hey, listener. Today I'm speaking with Tian Zhao. He's from Canada, the Toronto area. So first guy on the show from Canada. So welcome, Tian. Could you just introduce yourself to the listener? Just give me like the highlight, you know, the high level highlight reel of like your career so far, and we'll go from there.
Sure thing. Thanks, Caden. So, my name is Tian. I'm currently living in Toronto and doing some product design work for a dev shop that's focused on working with clients within the Web3 ecosystem. And I got into the Web3 space or blockchain space ever since 2015 when I first met Vitalik Buterin, the founder of Ethereum. Subsequently, I did a bunch of design work within this space. But of course, I'm not going to go into all of the details. I'll just say some highlighted companies I've worked for within this space have been Kleros, that's K-L-E-R-O-S, Consensus, largest venture studio in this space, did some design work, Raise, this social enterprise that's based out of Africa that's trying to build a corporate asset management solution for the African diaspora.
So you've really jumped into designing for like blockchain technologies. And you mentioned that you're trying to design for Web 3.0. Like, what is Web 3.0? And like, what technological advances are making it like the next iteration in the web?
Sure thing. Without getting too technical, I'll just, in order to first define Web 3.0, we have to have a broad general understanding of what the first one was and the second one was. So the first web, or first version of it is otherwise known as the read-only web. And then the second one is the read-write web. And the reason why is because So during the dot-com bubble of the 2000s, those websites were just websites. They were static. You could only write into it by as a creator, but you couldn't write into it as a reader of the website. Then Web 2.0 came along, and really what was the technological advancement that gave birth to the second iteration? It is cloud computing. So with cloud computing, you could create an account. You could have, you know, a username and password, and therefore write into whatever website, and thus those websites became, and thus gave birth to dynamic websites, otherwise known as web apps, right? And so Web 3.0, there is no clearly established definition for it just right now, just because it's still in the process of maturing. One way that a lot of people have been defining it is just that it is powered by distributed computing, aka decentralized systems, aka blockchain. Of course, there are hundreds of blockchains or thousands of them by now, so it's not really any one blockchain, but the one that is kind of the one that really put it on the map was the Ethereum blockchain. So that's a definition.
Yeah, okay. So it's based off of blockchain technology, and you know, based off what I know about blockchain, it's like kind of this distributed ledger, so like it logs actions and it can't, and then it gets encrypted so that you can't change that information.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike, but with like a normal database that you'd use in like Web 2.0, you could like fudge the numbers. You could add stuff to the spreadsheet. You could delete things. And so, like, what value add does it create for the world if you use like blockchain technology to power the next generation of like web products?
Yeah, great question. There are many different angles and perspectives and already use cases that are out there that that people have written about and talked about. So I'm not going to go into all of that, of course. What I will say is at the core of it, the benefit is having more truthful data could make the internet or could make for more efficient processes or processing. What do I mean by that? Like right now, because a lot of the data is like, even though it's centralized within X, Y, or Z company, that data is, there is a lot of unnecessary duplication of data there's a lot of, you could easily, as you said, fudge the numbers or fudge the data, right? Like you could create an account on one product slash company and say that you are 30 years old in that company. Let's say they ask you for your age in that company. But then in another product, you say you're 25 years old. In another product, you can say you're 20 years old. And maybe you're just using that as a benign, maybe you're a person that's not trying to be harmful by lying your age, but sometimes there could be people who could, sorry, I'm stuttering a lot.
Don't worry about it.
But basically what I'm trying to say is like, because you can fudge information in these different applications and there's no way for them to like ensure that data is truthful, there could be bad actors that can create some bad circumstances from that. And so this is why during the crypto bubble, there was a lot of blockchain companies at that time, startups that said, we are the single source of truth for X, Y, or Z. Like you would have maybe like a health tech blockchain startup that would say, we will provide a single source of truth for your medical records, or a supply chain based one that would say, we would provide the single source of truth for fish data, where they're fished from the beginning to where they're consumed at the very end of this supply chain. and so on and so forth. And you might have looked at that and might have thought, well, what's the value in that? Or you might have thought that's cool. And the reason why you might have thought it's cool is because it is actually, it could be very useful to have a single source of truth of whatever data.
Yeah, okay. So having more truthful data, like what's a practical example? So actually, I could think of one. I remember being approached by this startup founder, and they're working on something that would distribute basically like a logistics network. So like truckers could, you know, I mean, it was basically like what Uber Freight's doing now, but they would use blockchain to kind of distribute these like loads, like the supply chain of like where this package is, and then like that package being tracked all the way to delivery using blockchain to kind of control, like log that stuff, and then by logging it, that would create accountability to whoever's shipping that package, right? So you can know exactly where it was lost, because you know there's package theft, there's damage control. It creates a sense of accountability because you can't alter the blockchain. But so that seems like a practical example, is that it creates accountability on the web.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, like, accountability is very good. It's altruistic. I'm just trying to see, like, how can a more accountable technology, like a more accountable ledger, like if whatever data is being logged in any workflow, in any product, like if it's being logged truthfully, or by necessity, it needs to be logged truthfully, then what does that kind of allow us to do with our technology? Like, what kind of experiences are possible because of this?
Sure, sure. I already have an easy answer for you, but it's not been designed yet, because I think the technology is still, as I said, maturing, or in the process of. Anyway, I think one user experience change that could occur would be the doing away of unnecessary form fields that capture information in an unnecessary manner.
That would make it very interesting, because, you know, a lot of like interfaces and form fields and stuff aren't that smart. It's just kind of checking boxes off in like a database table, and it's not very like sophisticated technology. So I'm interested to see how this is going to play out.
Yeah.
So keep going.
Okay, sure. Thanks. So yeah, I mean, like, I feel like, you know, there's a lot of form fields that capture information that I kind of feel like, why do I have to enter this every single time? Not even just username and password. And there's already been countless articles talking about, you know, oh, let's try to kill the username and password. But ignoring that, barring that, there's already so many different other form fields that are out there that, like, I hate having to enter every single time. Like my home address or my mailing address, shipping address, whatever. Like, there should just be. Okay, so on the one hand, you might say, well, then, okay, so then there should just be like a database out there that has everyone's address. But then you wouldn't want that, right? Like, you wouldn't want a centralized database that has that information, because that would be totalitarian. That would be scary. Like, if all these companies would have access to one centralized database of that information, then that centralized database, whoever owns that, has a lot of power, right? Like I said, it could be very scary. It could be very 1984. So that's why don't we should decentralize some of these pieces of information that is used a lot, that is commonly used a lot in a bunch of different applications that are out there. And so if you can have that decentralized database or a distributed ledger of these pieces of information, then if an application needs that information, they wouldn't have to ask you to type it in. They could ask you to maybe just, like, they could just instead of asking you to type it in, they could ask you to verify whether or not it is true. It is like, instead of being presented with, a form, we have to enter your address. They could just be like, is this your current address? And you could be like, yes or no. That would make for a much more, efficient and quick user experience, right?
But you said there's multiple blockchains. So that would mean that there at least needs to be like some kind of like stewardship. So when Ethereum made their blockchain, so I think like crypto is probably the easiest and like way to understand how like Web 3.0 can work. And it's taking away like a financial like form of value from governments. And it's allowing people to exchange value with no like head, like no central bank or anything, right? It's like it's Bitcoin's made by computers. And so would you say that like any like product that you're working on for Web 3.0 right now is to kind of enable kind of like the data entry of people's information into this distributed network? And then if you wanted to like sign up for a service, you would just use like your blockchain key. If you want to make like a purchase using Bitcoin, you need to use like your wallet identification. Yeah. Like there's something that's tied to you uniquely. Mm-hmm. And then that would autofill all the information needed to facilitate a transaction crypto. Are you saying that any like Web 3.0 companies, you're going to be trying to get, are you saying like the future is that everyone's information is distributed, it's not owned by any company? And if you want to get like a service from a business and they want to provide you value, that instead of like signing up into their database, you just tell them who you are through the blockchain.
Yeah. Man, that's a, that was like a long question. And I feel like there's a lot of things I could say. One.
Yeah. Sorry. It's a lot to unpack, right? Because I'm still thinking out loud myself.
Yeah. No worries. But, no worries.
Does that make sense? Like, I'm just thinking out loud.
It does. You know what? Okay. I think I could say, I'll have 3 points to that. So point number one is, I'll first address your earlier part of this question about there are multiple blockchains. So yes, there are multiple blockchains, and one might be like, well, so then you can't have a single source of truth if there's so many of them, right? Yeah, and so that's why there is this there's this problem in the blockchain space. It's called interoperability, or the problem of interoperability, and it's basically just how do we solve for having multiple blockchains talk to one another, so how do we make it more interoperable? And there are already a multitude of solutions for that too, such as Polkadot or I can't name any other ones at the top of my head right now, but that's just one that comes at the top of my head. So yes, there's already people pondering about it and solutioning for that. I would also say, though, that even actually ignoring interoperability, I would say that, and a lot of people would say, that Ethereum really actually is the king of all the blockchains right now. 90% of decentralized applications are built on top of the Ethereum blockchain. And a lot of different blockchains are offshoots of Ethereum. So
when you say applications built on Ethereum, you're not just saying like the actual cryptocurrency of Ethereum, but you're actually saying like actual like web apps.
Yes.
Being built on. Okay, interesting. So like you just put it on the more popular blockchain, and like that's like best practice. Put it on the Ethereum blockchain when you're building your apps. It's almost like picking like iOS or Android.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, basically. I mean, it's like, oh, yeah, it is like picking an operating system. Yeah. I mean, and in fact, like Ethereum is there's two different names for Ethereum. One is Bitcoin 2.0, and when I say Bitcoin, so here's actually a quick fun fact. Uppercase Bitcoin with an uppercase B is the blockchain that powers the cryptocurrency of Bitcoin with a lowercase b.
There you go.
Yeah, and so that's why Ethereum, which is the blockchain that powers the cryptocurrency of Ether, is Bitcoin 2.0. Yeah.
All right. Actually, I'd like to go down that thread a little
Sure.
bit more, if you
Sure.
don't mind. So like if you're like a product manager and you're working on creating a company on the blockchain, and that could be like for business reasons or for ethical reasons, like choosing like the viability of like what blockchain you build upon is like, oh, we're going to do Ethereum because that's going to reach the most amount of people that are inputting things into the blockchain there. Does that
Yeah,
make sense?
that does, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I mean, there are other blockchains, of course, that'll compete for developers' attention. And so that's why, like, pretty much every blockchain, if you go onto the website, they always have developer docs. They always have, like, are you a developer? Sign up for this. Sign up for our newsletter. Sign up for, go check out our GitHub, et cetera, et cetera. But Ethereum right now is the most popular. I mean, and like the one of the co-founders of Ethereum, Joseph Lubin, called it the killer blockchain ecosystem or killer ecosystem.
Yeah, okay. And so the main reason that you'd want to build on the blockchain is more for the long-term benefit is creating more reliable and trustworthy data.
As well as, I mean, so another way of defining Web 3.0 is that it's going to be a user-driven internet, or a user-centered internet.
So why is that? Why, how is it more user-centered than it is now?
Right now, I would say that it's not user-centered because the data is not owned by you, right? It's owned by these big companies. Another way to say is, I think centralized or cloud computing enables internet monopolies to easily be built or created. But distributed computing would not enable monopoly or monop companies to become monopolistic. They could become oligopolistic, but not monopolistic. Yeah.
Oligopolistic. What's that?
So an oligopoly is like right now we would say that there is an oligopoly of big tech companies that are okay. So I gotta take back that what I just said. Oligopolies are like monopoly is like just a handful of monopolies that are competing against one another. But when I said oligopolistic, I guess I so yeah I guess I gotta take back what I just said. Because that kind of defeats the purpose. I feel like
Yeah, okay.
it's not so much oligopolistic in the sense that there are monopolies competing against one another. Okay, no, it would be all.
Yeah,
Oh,
just
sorry.
think. Keep going. Keep going. Think out loud.
Okay,
It's
thank you.
okay. That's what this
Yeah.
podcast is for.
Okay, so it would be a different kind of oligopoly. Instead of an oligopoly of companies competing one against one another, it would be an oligopoly of companies cooperating with one another, but they would have all as a collective an oligopolistic I guess access to whatever data or whatever data set. So like that is why I gotta throw out this conjecture or theory or whatever. Like I wrote an article about this. It's about if web 2.0 if the dominating business model of web 2.0 is software as a service, then what is going to be the dominating business model of web 3.0? So the answer I wrote in that article is actually something I borrowed from Andreessen Horowitz. who's they're considered one of the early adopters of Bitcoin and Ethereum and just this entire Web 3.0 movement. And, you know, they're one of the founding fathers of Silicon Valley. So like, that's why they're highly regarded. And so they wrote about what would that business model be. And they called it the crypto economic cooperative. I know it's a mouthful, doesn't roll off the tongue. like, I'm going to build a crypto economic cooperative today. Like, yeah, that doesn't really, you know, sound as cool as I'm going to build a SaaS product, right? It doesn't sound as sassy. it is, I guess. So if anything, there will be a different name for it down the road. Like, there'll be a more popular term for it at some point. I would just say that the term is not necessarily crypto economic cooperative, but it should be data collective.
So, like, okay, cooperative. So, like, what do they mean by that? Like, is it forced? Is it forced cooperation because of how everything's distributed a certain way? Like, what was a business model look like then? Like a practical example.
Yeah. So a practical example would be. I would say though, like, there are examples, but they're not fully formed yet because the technology is still maturing. I know. I hate always saying that. But it's the truth. But
we'll be a futurist.
Right.
Like, in the future. Like, a business could be like this.
Sure.
Tell me a little more about that.
Okay. Yeah. Let's imagine instead of the big five. Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm going to go back to my earlier thing with like. Oh, man. Okay. I got another. Oh, I got a good one. Okay. I have a problem. I'll start with a user problem. So my user problem is I hate having to go in a government agency to renew my driver's license or renew my health card. Like, physically having to walk into that building, wait in line for 3 hours just so I can show them some pieces of identification. And then after 10 minutes, you know, for them to tell me they're going to send me a new card a couple weeks later. Like, isn't that just like a crappy user experience? What if, and the reason for it is because, you know, these government agencies, they'll say, oh, well, we need to make sure you say you are who you are, right? And so you have to show up in person. So yes, it makes sense right now with the current technology we have. But if our data, if our identity data becomes distributed, then that helps with verification of who you are. If multiple organizations own the same data, and the majority of them say the same thing about you, then the government wouldn't need to see you in person. They could just access this distributed database that would have that truthful data about you. And then all you would have to do is maybe, just take a picture of yourself, or you would just have to go through a verification process, but remotely. You could do it remotely. And as long as it matches up with all the other databases that have that same information, like, as long as a consensus is reached, then after you go through that online, like, form or whatever, it could just say, okay, we will mail you your driver's license in 5 business days. And so instead of going in line, you can just do it online, remotely.
So it would enable like a very like reliable way to authenticate if you are who you are. And because of that, it could replace a lot of, like, I mean, I think a lot of like government use cases where I have like a friend from Italy, but he lives in the US and he had to renew his green card. So he had to drive to the Italian consulate from Utah all the way to San Francisco to renew his green card. And I'm like seeing how that would be a benefit if you could look that up. But aren't you worried that if everything's distributed and accessible by everyone in the blockchain like that, like people could find out a little
No,
too
because
much
it's
about you?
encrypted, right? And so, like, yeah, you have pseudonyms. Your information is all, yeah. And this could help with just a multitude of other use cases. Sorry, I'm not going to go into that right now. But yeah, it's encrypted.
Yeah. So it's encrypted. So how would the DMV decrypt it? Like how would you as a company, if you wanted to tap into Ethereum, and like there's like mass adoption of putting your data on Ethereum.
Because so even though it's encrypted, this is why we say that Ethereum is not necessarily anonymous, it's pseudonymous. So instead of knowing, instead of your name being in this public ledger that's distributed, it's an address. And so for the average person, they're not going to be able to put the two and two together unless if you explicitly tell someone and say, hey, look, my address, my 16-digit hash code is associated to Tianyuan Zhao. If you don't explicitly tell people, then they're not going to be able to know. And unless if you're working at the CIA or NSA or CSIS here in Canada, you won't be able to have the know-how to be able to like go deep into uncovering who this person is. Yeah.
Okay, so then how would businesses cooperate with each other? Like how would you, is it like you, since you own that encryption key, right? Because that's what's called, right? Like when you have like Bitcoin, you have an encryption key that would decrypt it when you want to give someone money, or like you want to trade in Bitcoin. So like if you're going to this DMV example, you'd be able to use some kind of like to token or totem. Like just like there's something that allows you to provide that information and give them access to that part of the blockchain. So if you as the holder of that encryption key give that permission to a business, then you're giving them permission to talk to the crypto chain, the blockchain on your behalf. I guess so.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's pretty cool. I'm just wondering, like, I mean, obviously we have these big monopolies and oligopolies, as you put it, and they make their wealth off of owning the customer data. And so like this wouldn't exactly benefit them, right? Like how, and like if there's no, and I'm sure there's a lot of businessmen out there that would love to be as big as Google or Facebook. Like why would they adopt blockchain technology if it's not going to allow them to grow big and make a lot of wealth? Because it's not like appealing to their ethics isn't exactly like a very persuasive argument to these kind of like people, right? So like what, like how do you, does it have to be regulated
So what
in?
I would
Like
say to that
what's going
is
on here?
there's definitely ooh. Yeah, it's hard to distill it down, but I think, and thanks to a recent development in one of the most biggest tech companies, Google, I can easily answer that, I think. I'll start by saying that, and this is not just my opinion. This is, a lot of people in the Web3 space would say the same thing. Blockchain is one of the only industry 4.0 technologies that. Or is the only industry 4.0 technology, I think, that lends itself, or I'm going to use a design term here, that has an affordance for social impact, positive social impact. And so, whereas AI has a negative affordance of towards and a lot of people have talked about it, like AI has this negative affordance towards tyranny, towards like all the 1984 stuff, the Orson Welles fears that people have, right? So with that said, am I trying to say that, oh, blockchain is some scion of, or some like messiah of a technology? In a way, yes, but like it still has to work in tandem with the other, with the other exponential technologies or industry 4.0 technologies of AI and IoT. But okay, this still doesn't get to the heart of your question, so I'm getting there. thank you.
No, keep going.
So this is okay. So this is why I would say two things. One is, as much as you're right about how a businessman in the Western world or a developed part of the world might be like, oh, well, I want to be a monopoly. So why would I want to, you know, do what you said, build this Web 3.0 business? It doesn't make sense to my greedy nature or whatever. Sure. But at the same time, we have seen in the last several years, a lot of, you know, I mean, like the Senate has been called, the U.S. Senate has been calling for, you know, these antitrust hearings. There's been all these documentaries like The Great Hack, Social Dilemma, Black Mirror that have been revealing to the average user the problems of the current internet, essentially. And there's been a lot of even call outs for more ethical practices in these companies, like the movement of ethics and AI. And recently with Google, there's been a huge there's been several walkouts previously, right? But recently, the Google employees have banded together to create a union. But not only that, they've actually, I don't know exactly if like how many of the people from the union formation, I don't know how many people, how many Googlers within that are doing this other thing, but like there's a sizable amount of them that have created a separate organization that is like Googlers for blockchain or something like that. It's just like these Googlers that are banding together to try to further the Web3 movement. And then there's been this other development with Google with like their chief of AI ethics or something. She got let go for writing a paper, you know, internally that calls out their bad practices or whatever. I don't know. Bloomberg covered this. I don't know all the details. But just point is like, if an individual business person in the Western world doesn't want to do it, fine. But like, there's this movement towards more ethical practices and caring about user data. And so I think it's inevitable that they're going to have to. It's not that they may not want to, but they're going to have to, essentially, is what I'm saying. But, I feel like.
So you're saying it's regulation that's going to implement it? Or are you just saying that like eventually like this is going to be the backbone of the internet and you're going to have to like build your stuff on it if you want to do business? Is it like a regulation thing?
With a lot of things in this world, it's going to be both bottom up and top down. I don't think it's going to be just one way or the other. And then I wanted to further your question with another perspective. So this is in the Western developed world. I want to say that this is going to be a technology that's going to be adopted more so, and already more so, profoundly within the developing world. In particular within South America, within African countries, within Southeast Asia. And it's already happening because they lack the Web 2.0 infrastructure, / they don't want to be digitally colonized by, you know, the big five American tech firms, right? So there's already articles about this. The leapfrog effect is already occurring, in particular within African countries, such as Kenya. And so they're going to leapfrog into the Web3 from whatever their current, I don't even know if they would even consider that their current ecosystem is Web1. But either way, they're going to leapfrog into it.
Okay. So you're saying that like these other countries that don't have like the first world infrastructure are going to want to jump towards blockchain, which I think is true. There's like a Medici Land Governance, which is a startup within Overstock and they're putting land records in blockchain. And so like people with like ancestral farms in Africa could claim land ownership. And then like use that to back a loan so that they could start a small business or so. Yeah, like I've definitely seen that where the blockchain would really help countries with I don't know, poor governance, if that's the best way to put it, where the you know like their currency is not that stable. It'd be better to use crypto to exchange value because that's more stable than the government. It's easier to assert land ownership using crypto. I mean, blockchain technology. So I mean, I guess, yeah, I mean, it's definitely like great for countries that maybe the government isn't helping as much. And I don't want to be too much of a libertarian on the podcast, but you confidently say that, places like Venezuela are like a failed state and crypto technologies or I mean, blockchain technologies could have helped, maintain stability over there. I mean, basically, what I'm getting from you is that we're so early on, but I mean, yeah, like the possibilities are very interesting.
But I just want to, I want to bring attention to a real world example of a collective or digital collective that's in the crypto space or crypto economic collective or whatever. It's called the Celo Alliance, and they're working towards enabling these developing countries. In particular within Africa, to leapfrog into the Web3. And they have a stable coin that they've created. So a stable coin, for those who don't know, are price stable coins. It's in its name. So yeah, people might be like, well, cryptocurrency is volatile. Yes, the average cryptocurrency is. But there is an entire taxonomy of cryptocurrencies out there. And one of the classifications that exists is a stable coin. And so that's why they're using a stable coin, not Ether or Bitcoin or Litecoin or what have you. Oh, and another fun fact. Oh, sorry. Just another fun fact about the Celo Alliance was that it was partially created in response to what Facebook did with Libra or whatever they rebranded to recently. I forgot.
Yeah, Tian, this is all like interesting stuff, and I'm sure it's not the end of this conversation in the long term, but it's like I think that there's so much opportunity in like Web 3.0 to like kind of help countries that are economically challenged, and kind of providing like this technology would really help with that. That's like the big takeaway for me. I'm gonna ask you a question I ask every guest. What's a setback that you're glad happened because it probably put you on a path towards a different opportunity?
Yeah. Okay.
Or something like that.
I think So the answer to this question is during the summer of 2017, I almost had a chance to work in Africa, but I unfortunately lost it because of, and it's a long story, but long story short, it's because of a misunderstanding of my mental health situation. It involved my mental health where basically during one of the, oh my gosh, okay, it's kind of hard to explain, but I got accepted to this program called the Engineers Without Borders Long-Term Fellowship Program. Basically, it's a nonprofit that provides you with the opportunity to work in a company that they fund and support in Africa, in African countries. So I was given an offer and I took it at the time to work for this fintech company in Uganda called Numita, as a UX UI designer. I was ecstatic. I was super happy. I was super excited. I got everything ready, got all my shots and everything. And, how this program works is during the first, so before they fly you over there to work, they put all the fellows, in a house called the EWB house, to just live with each other for a month, to get to know one another, befriend one another, but also it's a month of training to help you get ready to work abroad in Africa. And without going too much into all the details, this was a very unique experience for me, and I think for anyone, but for me, especially because I've never really experienced this level of camaraderie with different people before, because I grew up as an only child and just a bunch of other reasons. But anyway, so during the first week, during one of the first nights after we came home from a night of drinking and fun, I got very emotional and I'd said something that made one of the other fellows thought that I was suicidal. I wasn't, I just was very emotional. And it came out wrong. But basically, long story short, the program leaders caught wind of this and they got scared. They got spooked and thought that I was actually suicidal. And so they respectfully let me go, released me from the program. But they were nice about it. Like, they paid for my hostels. They paid for a couple weeks or so. They even gave me a food stipend. I was able to, eventually get a place to live for the rest of the summer. I still wanted to have an international experience, a long-term international experience. So I just ended up getting accepted to another program called the Digital Product School, where I got to work abroad in Germany for 3 months, and create my own app from scratch, or design my own app from scratch, from end to end, utilizing the Double Diamond design thinking process with a team. And we had a great time. I had a great time. I got to explore other parts of Europe. I got to visit. Yeah, so it basically became like my only experience to explore, my first time exploring Europe as a whole. I got to inspire the product manager of the team that I was in to end up starting his own company called Passbase. And they're doing very well for themselves right now. If you're curious, they're called, once again, Passbase, PASSBASE. And they're based in Berlin. I'm just very proud of their progress, because they wouldn't have done what they have done if I wasn't there to do what I did with them in that program. So I kind of feel like I spiritually founded that company, even though I, you know, didn't actually. just a lot of other awesome things occurred from that trip, and it boosted my confidence, and I came back and ended up getting employment right away, and just the rest is history. And yeah, I think that it ended up for the better, because of, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, worked out. It definitely led to you exploring more like crypto startups and stuff. And yes. I'm sure, yeah, it turned out pretty good. Tien, so much for coming
on the
show.
Too. Thank you. Thank you.
You have a good one, man.
Hey, listeners. Thanks again for listening to another episode of The Way of Product Design. If this episode resonated with you, please share it with your network and write a couple lines on why you found it useful. And if you haven't already, subscribe to the podcast. And if you want to help the show grow, please leave a review on Apple or Google's podcast platforms. As always, thanks for listening. You have a good one.